right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show today, so I'm going to be a little bit quick on the introductions. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Guy Davidi. Guy is the co-director of the film Five Broken Cameras, and we're going to be talking about his efforts to get that film shown in schools in Israel and efforts that are being met with a lot of resistance by the Israeli Zionist regime. Before that, we'll be talking with Andy Worthington. Andy's the author of the Guantanamo Files and one of the initiators of the site Close Guantanamo. He's also known as one of the foremost experts on Guantanamo in the world, and we'll be talking with him about the 11th anniversary of the Guantanamo prison, so the Guantanamo dungeon. So I look forward to that. Opening the show up, I am really pleased to welcome back to the show a person who always brings insight and, you know, some gripping knowledge to the show when he appears. He's Richard Falk, and he's the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. And he's just returned a couple months ago from a visit to Palestine in the wake of the Israeli assault on Gaza, and has a lot to say about what's going on there, and including, which we'll get into a little bit later in the discussion with him, the way he's come under attack by various forces for standing up and fighting for the interests of the Palestinian people in the world. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Always good to be with you.
Great, man. Well, let's jump into this. Towards the end of the last year, you were able to enter Gaza. And was this the first time that you've been able to do this as the UN Special Rapporteur?
Yes, it's the first time. I've been there since I had this position. I had been to Gaza twice before, once for a UN fact-finding mission back in 2002, and once to attend the first human rights meeting ever held in Gaza, which was in the late 1990s during the early honeymoon period of the Oslo peace process.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know that, you know, you obviously clearly learned a lot about the dynamics of what's going on in Gaza during those visits, but also over the years you've gathered up a lot of information from other sources, from secondhand sources, from indirect sources. So what I'd ask you is, having gone to Gaza, what did you find? Did you find anything that surprised you, or what did you find that you were able to actually get a better understanding of by visiting there?
Well, it was a short visit, but very intense, and gave me some awareness that you can only have by the direct experience of what the people living under a blockade that has lasted for more than 5 years, with continuous incursions of violence that can be at any moment without warning. And it is that's extraordinary, to be in a place where there's no escape from what might be regarded as a permanent war zone. And to grow up in that kind of atmosphere is something that I don't think any of us can appreciate without having been there. And even then, as a short-time visitor, you don't get the depth of feeling that seems to affect the population that has been born, grown up, and died in Gaza under conditions either of this kind of constant threat of violence for which there is no real response, and a sense of being confined within this crowded, impoverished area. At the same time, there was a big difference from the time I had been there a decade earlier, and that was the so-called Israeli disengagement, which occurred in 2005, didn't end the occupation, which continues by controlling the border, the airspace, and the waterfront. But what has changed is that without the Israeli armored personnel carriers with machine guns perched on their top, patrolling the streets, you do have within Gaza a greater sense of normalcy, that people can, under these severe constraints that I've described, live their life without having constantly to confront either Israeli military forces or checkpoints throughout the Gaza Strip. So in that sense, the situation is different in a better way, I think, for the people. Also, they had just survived this latest attack in November that caused devastation and involved some attacks on residential areas where lots of children were killed. And this is always traumatizing, not only for the victims and their families, but for the communities as a whole. And again, speaking with those people who had just endured this kind of tragedy does give you a different existential understanding of what's going on there. Mm-hmm. One more thing is that aside from these problems that are created by the Israeli occupation and concept of how to deal with Gaza, is the underlying situation caused by insufficient and polluted water, by insufficient land for agriculture, and a sense that the future of the Gaza Strip is very much at risk. The UN has published a careful study that suggests that by 2020, Gaza will become uninhabitable, which is a horrible prospect considering that 1.6 million people live there. And some of the experts we spoke to while I was there suggested that that was too optimistic, that by 2016, it's likely that it will not be possible to really sustain a viable society in Gaza. And already there's a health crisis, and many people are forced to rely on impure water for drinking and washing. So it's the underlying infrastructure is very much at risk in Gaza.
Yeah. Just a quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. You know, you've described a lot of the things that you're describing. You've talked about in a broad sense as collective punishment of a whole people, which actually is a war crime. And I'm thinking about this in relation to how you're looking at all this stuff happening and a couple of things that you've spoken to more recently, including in your speech in Cairo on the Solidarity with Palestinian People Day. The point of not just the collective punishment, but the idea that settler colonialism and the idea that there's now 600,000 settlers permanently living in the occupied territories and what that means for the future of the Palestinian people. I mean, there's one thing about and this is horrendous and just unthinkable that Gaza could be by 2016 uninhabitable. You know, this is outrageous. And then you think about what's happening and what that has to do with settler colonialism.
Yes, Michael, I'm glad you raised that because I think it's an extraordinarily illuminating way of thinking about the whole ordeal of the Palestinians. At the very historical moment when colonialism was collapsing throughout the world, Israel and Zionism has launched this new colonial project of a massive character with the backing of the United States, and has been able to reverse the trend of history so far as the Palestinian people are concerned. So they're living not only under an oppressive occupation or in refugee camps and in exile, but they're also victimized by this new form of settler colonialism that has taken their resources, including the most fundamental ones like water and land, and has subjugated an entire people, not only the people of Gaza, to a situation for which one finds no prospect of a solution. And the talk about two-state consensus that will provide Palestinians with their right of self-determination is empty talk. The settlements contradict that. And recently, after the General Assembly voted to regard the Palestine as a state without membership in the UN, Netanyahu used that as an excuse to launch a new cycle of dramatically expanding the existing settlements and defying world public opinion, even U.S. opinion on the legality, morality, and political prudence of engaging in further settlement activity. So it is a very dire picture, I think.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine, Richard Falk. Now, Richard, as you talked about that, I kept thinking about another point you've hit on quite often, too. You talked about just now about opinion in the U.S., and the opinion in the U.S. is one thing, but the actual, drive and needs and what this whole U.S. imperialism is pushed to do, there's a question that you've raised in terms of the geopolitics of the region and what they're trying to refashion in that part of the world and how that plays in with the what's happening, what's being done to the Palestinian people. And then again, too, the idea that you talked about, which I found very, very important, the significance of Israel's ambassador to the U.S. saying that the latest Israeli attacks on Gaza, that it was Israel wasn't confronting Gaza, but Iran, and it should be understood as a rehearsal for militarily engaging Iran. These are some pretty heavy things in terms of geopolitics.
No question. And it's very hard to disentangle what is done on behalf of America's grand strategy in the region, which, of course, centers not only on Israel, but on the energy resources there. The countries that have been subject to military intervention are oil-producing countries, Libya and Iraq, and Iran is on the list of countries that are threatened with an attack and have been, and it too is, of course, a major oil producer. So one has this resource dimension that is intertwined with the unconditional support of Israeli politics in the region that probably are present in the Syrian conflict and elsewhere, perhaps in relation to the Kurdish unrest in different parts of the region, so that it's a very complicated but important arena of post-Cold War diplomacy in the name of American grand strategy, which has shifted from its earlier European focus to the Middle East and to some extent to Asia in the relation to China. So we do have a new kind of geopolitical landscape in the world. That is being challenged, of course, in part by the rise of some of these non-Western countries such as China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey to some extent. So we need to really understand what is happening. And, of course, the Palestinians are caught between these various pressures. And with the recent upheavals in the Arab world, the Palestinian plight and struggle has been, at least in the international relations, has been marginalized to an unfortunate degree.
Well, let me ask you this, Richard, because that gets right to this question. You've talked about, in some of your recent writings, this new thing that's sort of appearing on the international scene, the responsibility to protect, and that being an international norm, a new international norm to guide the UN in responding to situations of humanitarian catastrophe. And you point out very sharply that yet, with even that being the case, it's never applied to the suffering of the Palestinian people at the hands of the Zionist regime.
Yes, well, that Michael, goes to the degree to which the UN is not an alternative to geopolitics, but an instrument of geopolitics. And especially since the end of the Cold War and the different orientation taken to global issues by Russia, the Western powers have more or less a free hand in determining where that responsibility should be exercised and where it should be suppressed. And so you have at one extreme Libya, and at the other extreme the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
Not the plight or need of a people that is vulnerable and enduring a humanitarian catastrophe, but rather the political priorities of the countries that exercise this geopolitical leverage.
We're talking with Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. Now, let me ask you this, Richard, because we're coming up on our time and I have a couple more questions that I know are going to be really that I want to get into. For all of your work in relation to the occupied territories of Palestine, you've come under attack a number of times around a number of things. And, you know, partly it's been, you know, you've come under attack from the Israeli regime. You've come under attack from various conservative groupings around the world. And most recently, you've come under attack from a group called UN Watch, as well as the Human Rights Watch here in the U.S. Is there anything you want to tell people about that? I mean, it seems to me there's been a lot of attempts at character assassination and really trying to sort of discredit you so they can move you off the scene and stop you saying what you're saying about Palestine.
Yes. I mean, I have been attacked since I took this UN job by UN Watch, which really should be called Israel Watch. It is not concerned with any issues other than protecting Israeli interests. And one principal way they do that is by attacking anyone that has an independent role or is critical of Israel. And this kind of extreme Zionism has redefined anti-Semitism to mean any criticism of Zionism or Israel rather than hatred of Jews, which is, of course, the underlying idea and, to me, the real idea, core idea of what anti-Semitism represents. But I'm accused by UN Watch all the time of being anti-Semitic and racist, and there's not a shred of evidence that supports that, and it's far from my real views. Human Rights Watch is a liberal organization that does good work in various countries, but is sensitive about identifying with someone like myself, who is seen as a critic of Israel, as I say, and has this UN job. So they didn't identify with the UN Watch attack, but what they were unwilling to do was to disassociate themselves from it when it was distorted by UN Watch publicly, so that the little incident which occurred was that UN Watch sent this defamatory letter to Ken Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, and he invoked a technicality about not having a conflicting role in government or the UN to remove me from Santa Barbara City Committee of Human Rights Watch, which was pretty ineffectual role that I had here for several years, even before I had the UN appointment. And then when UN Watch issued a press release saying that I had been dismissed and expelled by Human Rights Watch in response to the its attack, Roth and Human Rights Watch was unwilling to correct that impression. And so they left that impression in the public, and I've been attacked in France by other groups, Zionist groups, and elsewhere in the world. So it's a kind of unpleasant incident.
Yeah, absolutely unpleasant, and actually something that people really need to have your back on in terms of showing support for what you're doing and what you're saying. Now, one more question, Richard Falk, and this is one that I think you personify in what you're doing. You've made the point that you've joined with others who've called the denial of Palestinian rights the greatest moral issue of our times. Why?
Because it has been before us for a very long time. It has captured the moral imagination of many people in the world. That statement was initially made by Nelson Mandela, who is himself a kind of icon of moral sensitivity and of a struggle for the rights of an oppressed people. And I think no other issue has as strong a global reach and resonance as this one. Doesn't mean that there are not more people being killed in other places like Congo and maybe Myanmar. But what it does mean is that this issue, and especially for Americans, because we're so complicit in what's happened to the Palestinian people, this issue hangs over our collective reality like a continuous dark storm cloud that I think erodes and diminishes any claim we make to be a moral beacon for the world as a source of democracy and human rights and the like. Is a permanent indication of a fundamental hypocrisy and double standard.
Okay, Richard, thank you very much. And let me ask you real quick, you know, I'm going to give you about 3 minutes, but I know you can do it. You know, what's next? What's up in the future? You've talked about there's already troubling signs that Israel is undermining and, in effect, laying the foundation to ignore the ceasefire. You've also got, you know, things that you're talking about going from the speaking realm to actually advocating for certain activities to happen in support of the Palestinian people. What's next?
Well, I've said in the UN setting particularly, that the time for mere rhetoric has long passed and that it's time to take concrete action. In my last report to the UN General Assembly, we supported the BDS campaign, boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign that's growing around the world, and named particular companies that, including some prominent American ones, that have profited from their dealings with the unlawful settlements. We focused on these companies particularly because they represented a way of attacking the issue concretely, tangibly, and built a link that has been established for the first time between what the UN is trying to say about the Israel-Palestine conflict and what civil society has been trying to do through the BDS campaign and other initiatives.
Mm-hmm. All right, Richard, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Yeah,
take care.
You too, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Great.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Richard Falk, UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Andy Worthington to talk about Guantanamo, the 11th anniversary, and why it needs to be closed. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That was Chris Washburn and the Scioto's Band with Guantanamo. And here to talk with us about Guantanamo is, well, basically, I have to say, the foremost expert in the world on Guantanamo. What the hell is happening there? He's been writing about it, talking about it, fighting against it. His name is Andy Worthington. He's the author of the Guantanamo Files and one of the initiators of the site closeguantanamo.org and a frequent guest on this show. Well, not frequent but often enough. And he's always a pleasure to talk to. Andy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi.
Good to be back.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this. This is the 11th anniversary of Guantanamo, a mark of shame on the human psyche. No question about it. And really a horror for the people who are living and a horror for the people of the world and anybody that cares about humanity and the future of humanity. So give us an update. 11 years down the line, where are things at with Guantanamo?
Well, you know, I have to say, unfortunately, they're not anywhere. They're just stuck. It's kind of remarkable, really, if we look back 4 years to the hope and change president, and you know, even people who weren't too taken in by all the hype thought, well, you know, we're going to get rid of the Bush regime, we're going to have some kind of common sense approach to dealing with some of these terrible abuses of the law that took place under the Bush administration. I don't think at that time anybody, apart from really hard-bitten cynics, would have thought that 4 years down the line we would end up in a position that in many ways is worse than what would have happened had, you know, President Bush had a third term. You know, because under Bush, he knew that, you know, that an experiment that had, you know, that they'd all been into had actually kind of soured and that people had turned against it. Now there's no great movement anywhere to get the prison closed from within the administration. Lawmakers, for the most part, have either completely given up or are using it for their own cynical ends to try and promote an endless message of fear, keep the American people scared of the bogeyman. And there's just no impetus anywhere to actually bring any justice to the 166 men who remain in Guantanamo. It's very deeply depressing, to be honest.
Well, let's break that down a little more, because of the 166 men, how many of them actually were scheduled to be released or should have been released a while back and are still sitting in Guantanamo?
Well, I mean, you know, somewhere between 55 and 86 of them. Now, you know, the reason I mentioned those two figures is that, you know, this is all down to the deliberations that were made by the Guantanamo Review Task Force, which is a collection of very sober officials and lawyers from all the government departments and the intelligence agencies. The President Obama appointed 4 years ago. They spent a year going through all the prisoners' cases, and at the end of that, they said, you know, whether prisoners should be released, whether they should continue to be held, whether they should be put on trial. Now, you know, 86 of the 166 men still held, so that's over half of them. They said, you know, we want to release these people or we don't want to hold them forever. The reason there's a distinction is that 30 of them who are Yemenis, they said, we don't think they should be released until somebody, they didn't specify who or how, thinks that the security situation has improved in Yemen. But, you know, the other 56 people, they said, should be released. And they weren't. And most of these people, 55 of these people, their names were on a list that was released in a court case by the Justice Department in September last year. Just 3 months ago, it was the first time ever that their names had been made publicly available by the United States government. What's the holdup? You know, seriously, what is the holdup? Well, it's partly Congress, because lawmakers there have decided to erect barriers to what the president can or can't do regarding who is released from Guantanamo, claiming that, you know, countries are dangerous and that people shouldn't be released. They've really put up a lot of, I think, very cynical barriers. But of course, the president could, you know, he is the president of the United States. He could certainly do something about this, I believe, if the will was there. But the will isn't there. So we have a bunch of people stuck in Guantanamo, some of whom are supposed to be very dangerous and put on trial, some of whom are people that the United States doesn't want to carry on holding, and yet that distinction means nothing anymore. It doesn't matter whether they, you know, whether you have been told that the United States doesn't want to hold you anymore. It means nothing. And I think that's, you know, that's disgusting. I think that's shameful. But as I say, where is the impetus going to come from to get the American people to care in sufficient numbers that people who should be released are held in Guantanamo? No sign of when, if ever, they'll be released. And we go on and on.
You know, Andy, and I should remind listeners that we're talking with Andy Worthington, journalist, filmmaker, author of The Guantanamo Files, and one of the leading experts in the world on Guantanamo and the fight to close it down. And he's currently got a website called closeguantanamo.org, and a very important website, so people should be visiting that. Andy, one of the things I wanted to talk with you about is, you know, a lot of what happens is there's a tremendous amount of things that are just there's the lack of interest in a certain sense, and that or the settling in and the acceptance of all this terrible stuff that goes on from people broadly, and especially in this country. There's just a huge swath of people that just close their eyes. You know, they just ignore it. I don't want to know it. It disturbs me. They put their fingers in their ears and try to drown out any sense of what's going on. But what's concentrated in Guantanamo is very, very, very disturbing and outrageous. And it's, you know, the things of torture, renditioning, the idea that you can be put in a place and disappeared on, you know, phony evidence on and held with no contact with anybody anywhere, you know. And I wanted you to talk a little bit just so people know some of the conditions. You've been one of the greatest advocates for what you've said is the last British prisoner in Guantanamo, Shaker Amer.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read something that, you know, I think it was an article you wrote about the conditions that he has lived under, which I don't think people get when they're talking about it. They think, okay, well, the worst with Guantanamo is over. But you've described a situation with him that just is revolting when you see what has been done to this young man. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, you know, I mean, I've had over the last year, I was very privileged to have been, you know, Shaker Amer, the last British resident in Guantanamo, as you mentioned, he specifically asked one of his lawyers to make available the notes of their meetings so that I could, you know, tell his story. And, I mean, the worst of what Shaka's been through is probably in the past, but even the way that he's treated now is awful. I mean, you know, basically this is a man who, everyone who's met him says, you know, he's very intelligent, he's very eloquent, and he won't stand for injustice. So he, from the beginning, has been trying to get the United States government to treat the prisoners as human beings and to give them rights that prisoners would normally have. You know, he fundamentally has railed from the beginning against the notion that the United States had the right to create a category of prisoner who didn't have any rights, which is what Bush intended. And it's the main reason why it's so horrible that Guantanamo still exists. These people aren't criminals who are going to have trials. They aren't prisoners of war. They're still, you know, prisoners without rights, the enemy combatants that Bush dreamt up. So he's fought against this, and even now, when he's one of the 55 people on the list that the Justice Department released who has officially been cleared for release by the U.S. government, you know, for at least 3 years now. We know actually it's more than that. But, you know, this is printed in an official document. They don't want to hold him anymore. But within Guantanamo, he still resists. So he's been, you know, he gets taken out for a small amount of time every day. He's kept in isolation because he's, you know, considered disruptive, a man that they want to release. But he's considered disruptive, so they hold him in isolation. Then he gets a small amount of time for recreation. And as a protest, he's been refusing to come back in from recreation. So as a result of that disobedience, then he gets beaten up by the armed guards who were there to deal in this manner with anyone who infringes the rules in any way. It's a horrible little brutal game that's going on really there, in which, you know, how does this man get out of this? Why is this stuff happening? I mean, and I think really what's happening at Guantanamo is that the place has its own horrible logic, and that actually if you were to compare it to the domestic prison system in the United States, you would see more similarities than anything. In the sense that, you know, these are very, very hard places with a lot of violence and a lot of, you know, violence to treat infringements of the rules or perceived infringements. And the same thing is happening at Guantanamo, if you like, in that sense. It's a militarized version of it. But, you know, as I mentioned, that fundamental problem is that these are not people who have ever been convicted of anything. They've never been, they've never had a trial. They are in a kind of limbo, being punished as though they'd had a trial and a conviction and were somehow confirmed as some kind of bad guys, when they're not at all. You know, and that remains the troubling thing about it that I think people don't really understand. You know, that and imagine, if you will, that you're somebody who's been picked up and locked up for years like these guys, and that you have no idea when, if ever, you're going to be released. So it's not like a judge said to you, you know, here's a 10-year sentence and you know that's what you're going to serve. Or even if a judge said to you it's life without parole and you know and you can get your head around that, these guys don't know if they're ever going home. They have no idea what's going to happen to them. And I think that kind of mental stress is horrible. If I imagine myself in that position, waking up every morning not knowing what was happening, that's a lot worse than if you'd, you know, been through an actual legitimate process.
We're talking today with Andy Worthington. Andy is an author and a filmmaker, and he runs he's one of the initiators of the blog closeguantanamo.org. Now, let me ask you this, Andy, because there's been other things that have emerged in the news over the last week or so, very similar to what's going on in Guantanamo. You know, we have Guantanamo, and then we have all these black sites, some of which we saw in that disgusting film, Zero Dark Thirty. But then, you know, other places, all this stuff has been hinted at. But something emerged this week that, to me, was really, really sort of a shocker. And I thought, okay, this has to get out. And I wasn't shocked, like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. But it was just so repulsive. The fact that the Obama administration is continuing to embrace renditioning and all that that involves, including holding people in unknown sites and questioning them behind this veil of secrecy. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I obviously think that that we have very gray areas as to how people behave when they're put under pressure. And, you know, as the United States was after 9/11, how are we going to deal with this terrorist threat? And the number of responses, some of them involved, you know, innovative approaches to how to deal with the perceived threat, and some of them actually involve a kind of continuation and reinterpretation of ways that things have been done before. So what we had under Bush was, a really horrible system of widespread extraordinary rendition. Torture prisons, you know, the CIA getting into the torture prison business, and people being excluded from any kind of legal process. So the people at Guantanamo are this little pocket of the people whose rights were completely removed. They were taken from outside of any established legal process and just dumped there. It's why they're really, you know, in this horrible limbo still. Well, there are another few options as to how you can treat a threat. And one of the disturbing things that we've seen under President Obama, which has a continuity, it must be said, is that instead of apprehending people and then having to deal with the thorny question of how you treat them if you apprehend them, how about if you just assassinate them? Now, this has been a pretty horrible, you know, it started under Bush, but it's been escalated under President Obama. It's one of the main hallmarks, I would say, of the way that he has dealt with threats, which international experts around the world are aware that this is of seriously dubious legality, if not actually just downright illegal. But it's been one approach, and it's actually a return of the kind of assassination issues that were dealt with in the 1970s, where the United States started to run into problems, and through the 80s and 90s really grappled with these kind of issues. And they've come back, and, you know, and a suitable solution to problems has been found, that's been presented, you know, first of all to President Bush and particularly now to President Obama. Let's just take these guys out. Well, the story you're talking about is capturing people abroad, holding them under dubious circumstances, interrogating them under presumably very dubious circumstances, and then rendering them to justice, so bringing them to the United States and putting them on trial. And that's where I think it gets rather difficult, because we're not dealing with people being killed. We may be dealing with people being tortured, which, you know, obviously remains something disgusting that shouldn't be happening. But I think there's a certain logic to saying that it should be possible to apprehend people and put them on trial for crimes that they have allegedly committed, and in which case the problem then is the question of rendition. Is it acceptable to bring someone from one country to another to face justice, or is that in itself a form of kidnapping? And, you know, and I don't know the answer to that. I mean, you know, my instinct is to say, well, that's not acceptable. But what I'm trying here to understand is, given all the different options on things, what are perhaps the least bad ways of dealing with it?
Let me step in here for a minute, Andy. You know, first, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, author, filmmaker, and one of the initiators of the closeguantanamo.org website. and Andy has been leading a fight to get Guantanamo closed pretty much from the day it opened up. I think that's a problem that we're facing, Andy, is that people look too much at things. And I'm not saying this is certainly not something that marks your work, but this point that you were just making about looking at what's the least bad. And to me, there really is. I mean, I think it is outright. It's criminal to kidnap somebody on the basis of, as you were saying, dubious evidence that they end up in Djibouti, which is a major center for the U.S. supposedly anti-terrorist operations in the world. They're questioned in these dungeons, and then they show up in a U.S. court for a minute, 3 or 4 or 5 months later. And, you know, this is outrageous violations of every form of international law you can think of, not to mention just the basic dignity of humanity. And this stems from, because the other thing that the reaction in the U.S., the other thing never to forget, there's the reaction people had in terms of the stunned reaction to what happened on September 11th in 2001. But then there's also the reaction that the U.S. government, the U.S. system, the imperial system had in terms of, now we're going to reshape the world. Now we're going to get out there and we're, you know, the gloves are off. We're going out to rebuild the world in our image. And that, to me, has determined so much of what's going on in the world today, including the constant stuff with Guantanamo, including the most recent.
I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, that's the problem, is that if you're going to be capturing people in Djibouti where the U.S. is somehow involved in some kind of activities, then why is the first thing that we're not talking about the fact that, well, are we going to declare legally that we're involved in a war situation? And if we are, why are we not establishing prisoner of war camps? And it's part of how things have been blurred. And that's what I mean, is that I can understand that there is a difficulty in the sense that terrorism is actually a crime. So putting somebody on trial for terrorist-related activities makes sense in the sense that terrorism is a crime. If you're at Guantanamo and you're accused of terrorism-related activities, it's apparently a different form of terrorism. It's the kind of terrorism where you're not allowed to be put on trial in a federal court. You have to be put on trial in a special military court. Actually, what's happened after 9/11 is that the law, as we understand it, let's forget about morality and decency, but the law has been twisted into knots, and things actually literally don't make sense anymore in a lot of ways. And that's very troubling. If you can't actually objectively stand back and say what the law is and how it operates objectively and how it can be seen to be fair, then I think we're in a mess. And that is where we're at.
All right, Andy, on that note, being in a mess, I'm going to have to agree with you there. And I think actually some of the things we should think about for future discussions is those war criminals that should be, and those terrorists that should be actually arrested and facing accountability around all of this by the people of the world. George Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Obama, all of these people, let's see them stand up and face the accountability squads. All right.
Well,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely, man. There you go. All right, Andy, and you're going to be in Washington, D.C. for the demonstration January 11th,
That's right? I am.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And hopefully a lot of people will see you there. Andy, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
I'd like to encourage anyone who can get there to come down. We're going to be at 12 o'clock outside the Supreme Court. Then we're going to walk to the White House and we're going to demand that President Obama fulfills his promise to close Guantanamo.
All right, Andy, thank you very much for joining us.
All right, Michael.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Talk to you again soon, man. Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Andy Worthington, journalist, filmmaker, and one of the initiators of the CloseGuantanamo.org website. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to have a conversation with Guy Davidi, one of the co-directors of the film, a great film called Five Broken Cameras, and he's going to be talking about his campaign to get that film shown to school children in Israel, so stay tuned. I wanted to play more of that song, but I'm not able to because we're running up on time, and that is Stone in My Hand from Everlast and his album Love, War, and the Ghost of Whitey Ford. We'll play more of it as we go along, but I really am happy to, actually in a way, welcome back to the show Guy Davidi, one of the co-directors of Five Broken Cameras, just a great film that I saw at Sundance last year. I interviewed Guy and his co-director, Imad Burnett. Basically, I was really, really moved by the film, and I saw recently got a contact from a publicist that said that Guy is trying to get this film shown in schools in Israel and is having a hell of a time doing that. Guy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, you know, the last time we talked, it was snowing outside, okay? So how's that? Anyway, Tell us what's going on. First, give people a sense of what the film is altogether.
Yes. So Five Broken Cameras is a film that Imad, my Palestinian co-director, he documented from 2005. Imad is a villager from a village in the West Bank called Bilin. And in 2005, the villagers discovered that the separation fence is passing over the land and, in fact, confiscating more than half of their lands, agricultural lands. So they start a nonviolent movement, and they are joined by Israeli and international activists. And this movement is documented throughout 6-7 years by Imad, because Imad at that time, his son was just born, so he took a camera to film his son. And when the event started to happen, he just went out and started to film everything that happened in the village. And during the years, that turned out to be a very important documentation for all the events that happened in the village. And it became also a very personal film and family film, because we can see in the film the development and how it affects on his life and on his family, and how actually people are influenced by these social and political events outside. And so in 2009, he approached me, and we started working together to create that film. And for him, it was very natural to work with me, because it was already after years that Israeli activists were coming to the village and supporting him personally by giving him cameras when his cameras got broken. That's the reason for the name of the film, and supporting him in videotapes and supporting in general the village in the nonviolent movement. Yeah,
One of the things is the film actually went from being this small, really powerful film when you watched it, and especially given Imad, given Imad Bernat's his whole movement from being a farmer who then gets disillusioned with being a young farmer, a kid basically who gets disillusioned with all the stuff that's involved in village life and farming, but then gets involved in reclaiming the land and fighting to stop the seizure of the land. And you guys, when you did that, it won all kinds of awards. And I understand awards around the world. It emerged as a film that really grabbed people's hearts and delivered some message, some sense to people of what it means to be Palestinian and living in the occupied territories and living under the boot of the Zionist regime. You know, but then it even won awards, I understand, in Israel, where it showed, right?
Yes, the film is actually we managed to get Israeli partners, very good and important partners, the New Israeli Cinema Fund and Channel 8, which is a documentary channel, and they've been with us throughout all the process of the editing and of the creation of the film. They've been major supporter, and which happens a lot actually, and people are surprised by that. But we have a very independent cultural system that cannot be completely influenced by politicians and by government, so that's a very good thing. And what becomes a bit more difficult is the support regarding the distribution, because it's one thing to produce a film and to show it abroad and to get international awards like the Sundance Award and other awards, and now the film is shortlisted for the Oscars, so everybody is very excited, and the newspapers are reporting on the film, and something that causes a lot of pride, even though the subject is very sensitive and the film is criticizing strongly Israel politics and the military, but still there is a kind of support and pride amongst it, especially the media.
Let me remind listeners once again that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Guy Davidi. Guy is the co-director, along with Imad Bernat, of the film Five Broken Cameras. And we're talking about Guy's struggle to get that film shown to Israeli teenagers, Israeli high school students. Let me ask you this, Guy, because I want to jump right in here, because I want to make sure that people get the core message of what we're talking about today, which is, given all that, which is all important in what you're saying, you can't show it in Israeli schools and to high school students. You can't really show it within that system. And why not? And what are you doing about it? And why do you want to do it? You know,
first of all, this is the most protected system in Israel, because these teenagers now, in 3-4 years or less, sometimes they will be military soldiers. So that's part of the system that should not be harmed in Israel, because if at one point the youth decides not to go to fulfill their military service, the whole system collapses. The system of occupation, but also You know, we can discuss whether if the army is needed or not needed, or if if what the army is doing is defense or not defense. It doesn't matter for that sake. Just the fact that we are putting this to criticism and we are opening up the subject is something that the state is afraid of. So the Ministry of Education, especially nowadays, and when there's a strong right-wing movement in Israel for a few years now, is protecting by not exposing these kids to anything that happens. And by the way, the price is also for the kids, because at one point they discover what's happening and they're already in the military service. And this is a big shock for them. And by the way, just recently this week, it was released, was allowed to be released, and the military acknowledged for the first time that suicide is the number one reason for soldiers to die during the military service, much more than any other reason. Which I find connected. So for me, it's very important to expose this generation to what is happening. And then, you know, I don't open the subject whether they should do the military service or not, but they should completely be aware of where they're going to be posed in a few years from that point.
And in a sense, they really do need to understand also, you know, what the hell's going on with the Palestinian people? What's the situation with the Palestinian people? What are their lives like? They have to actually understand that in order to, you know, frankly, in order to be able to change the world. And I wanted to say something, Guy, because I remember when we first spoke, you mentioned to me that you went through a similar transformation in your own life where you began to understand some things about the bigger picture in the region. And you yourself, didn't you refuse to do military service?
Yeah, I had the chance to actually to do military service for 3 months. So I was recruited. I didn't refuse politically because I didn't come from a family that was left wing, or I didn't know anything about Palestinians. So I actually naively went to the military service, as everyone is obligated to do in Israel, for 3 years for men. And after a few days, actually, I discovered it's a shock. It's a shock because you discover another face of your country that you're not exposed to when you're in the school system. So because it's an obligation, then there's such a strong pressure. Either you change, and what the army is doing is re-education, and you're brainwashed, and you learn to fear and to behave differently. So either you accept it. And it's a very strong, you're young, you're 18 years old, so either you accept it or you don't, and when you don't, you have to refuse, and it's a very difficult thing to do. So if you refuse, you go to the jail for a year at least, or sometimes more. Or what I did after 3 months is that you try to go out on a mental reason, which is also a very difficult thing to do. So I went to that direction, and I didn't do the military service. Of course, that time it wasn't a political decision, but it later on led me to be open more to criticize politically and to discover more Palestinian narrative and a different narrative of Israeli and of Zionism. So not necessarily from a political background or a stronger decision of moral or ethical decision from advance, just from the shock of being exposed to a very violent system and a very oppressive system to the soldiers, to the Israeli youth as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Guy, one final question, which is, can you tell people, I know there's a lot of things that you're asking people to check out and to try and how they can actually stand up and help build support for this getting shown in the school system there. And I know you're also talking about showing it outside of the schools. If you can't get inside the school system, you're going to show it outside the schools and youth centers and whatnot. Where can people go to find out more information about your campaign?
Well, we launched a campaign over Indiegogo, so everyone can just surf to Indiegogo and look and type Five Broken Cameras and find the campaign, and you can contribute money, but you also can watch a beautiful 8-minute documentary that documents a screening that we had in front of a few 15-year-old and 15 and 16-year-old teenagers that watched the film. And that was kind of a test that we made to see what kind of reactions Israeli youth would have. And the result is absolutely beautiful. These were, it's a very positive, actually. It was much more positive than we expected, because actually teenagers are very much more open than people after the military service, who become much more closed and after kind of a brainwashed by the military and much more tired. And there's such an energy that there is in youth that is so hopeful the video is just amazing to watch. So I offer anyone, even if you don't want to contribute, just go and watch the video. It's a very strong short documentary about this.
Yeah, I have to say, I was very moved by it. Especially when you see these things, it is actually a lot like what you were saying. For a lot of these kids, it's the first time that they've even understood that what's happening, what the military is responsible for, and what's happening in sometimes areas and an area that's so close to their daily life, and yet they know nothing about it. And the kind of, you see people whose eyes are suddenly beginning to open, and it really, really is very moving and very powerful. So I think what you're doing is just a remarkable thing. We really need to, you know, get the word out about this far and wide. So Guy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, and talk to you again soon, I hope. Okay.
Yes, I hope.
All right, take care. My best to Imad, too. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Guy Davidi, one of the co-directors, along with Imad Burnett, of Five Broken Cameras, and we were talking about the campaign to get it shown in the school system in Israel and to show to the younger generation in Israel. Okay, that brings us to the end of another show. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. You know, I wanted to take this moment, this end of the show, to fill you folks in on what's coming up in the very near future. Next week, I will be debuting a very special interview that I had the opportunity to do with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. This is an extensive interview. It stretches over 3 hours, and we'll be airing it in 5 different parts. And next week, we'll be debuting it, as I said. And, you know, in this interview, Avakian argues why nothing short of communist revolution will deal with the howling problems we face today in the world. He digs into all the big questions, all those questions you know you have or your friends have, of how could this happen and what would the world look like if it did happen. Avakian is the Karl Marx of our times. Cornel West calls him the real thing. You don't want to miss this challenging and inspiring interview. That's the basic point. You can agree or disagree, but you do not want to miss the chance to hear the voice of Bob Avakian, a voice that is very much needed in the world today. So stay tuned next week and over the 4 weeks following that, where you'll get different segments of the interview. All right, so I want to thank my board op for today, Federico Garcia. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with another piece from Everlast, and that piece is Naked. Yep, that's right. And we're talking about the emperor or the president. Either way, they're both naked, so check this out. Yes.
Let it ride, lose your money, lose your pride. Easy came, easy went, ghetto slums and tenements. Things look real Old Testament, blame it out on the president. The emperor's got brand new clothes and everybody but him knows he's naked. But you don't say a word. The emperor's got brand new jewels. Wake up soon, you silly fools, he's naked.